May it please the court, I'm Dennis Polk, P-O-L-K. My attorney registration number is 8777. I appear on behalf of Mr. Sullivan, the appellant in this matter. I'd like to indicate to the court that this case has an unusual complexity that arises out of the interpretation of a series of documents. In 1986, Mr. Selby, who was the predecessor of Mr. Sullivan, granted an easement. That easement, in turn, was tied to a lease that was executed in 1955. That a portion of that 1955 lease was terminated by a separate agreement that was of record. The trial court, in looking at this matter, stated that the position of the appellant in this was illogical, defied logic. But I respectfully submit that this case, uniquely on its facts and interpreting the documents, should be reversed. And the reason it should be reversed, and I have three basic concepts that I would like to suggest to the court. First of all, the legal descriptions in all of these documents are a confusing matrix of facts. They refer to different tracts, different obligations arising under those different tracts. And interestingly enough, the easement that Selby granted affects a portion of Track D that Denver Country Club uses as a golf course. The appellee in this case argues that the consideration for the grant of that easement was the extension of a view easement over the same ownership that Mr. Selby owned at the time. This case, I think, bears very much in the same manner as the cases cited in our brief, the City of Arvada asset case, WWRC, I think is how it's referred to, and I mean, misquoted, seems to me to be parallel on its face because it talks about the necessity to have an easement running or a pertinent with land coupled with an interest. And the easement that was granted to the Denver Country Club is not apparent on its face coupled with any interest. And so therefore, we're dealing with arcane, archaic notions of easement grants and what they are and what they do. And I respectfully submit that that document may have been a nullity at the time of its original grant. And so therefore, there was logic in the pursuit of this claim by Mr. Sullivan. It is tied not only spatially on the earth through a description, but it is tied temporally to a lease. The easement grant in 86 says it terminates with the lease. Well, an examination of the original lease, the termination of the lease, shows that it was terminated as to Track E prior to the grant of the easement.
But so Council, but the Denver Country Club retained some interests. It didn't give up all of its interest. It just gave up the leasehold interest that it had as Track D. And so why doesn't the remaining interest that it still had suffice for it to later acquire an easement?
It appears, when you look at that, at least the affidavit of the surveyor that was filed in the district court in opposition to the motion for summary judgment, you're talking essentially about a separate grant or separate estate that was out there that they retained an interest in. There are multiple owners. The chain of title in this cannot be determined efficiently through the grantee-grantor index. That's part of the dilemma that one faces in this case. I'm saying that there are two different interests. If you look at who the termination interest ran to and the reserve interest, there is nothing on the face of any of these grants that show that they are related to the Tract E. I see I'm not answering your question.
You're not, and I'm also confused because the whole issue of the legal descriptions was not briefed to us, and I didn't see how it was presented to the trial court.
I think it was presented in the form of the affidavit with the accompanying map that shows that it goes through the history of the transaction and then the affidavit, I think is what presents that. And if I am not clear in that, we appended a copy of that actual map from the surveyor that shows these tracks. The easements, the grants, the lease, the terminations were all of record. And I think that it is the review of that that leads to the surveyor's affidavit.
And what in the easement document itself are you saying does not allow or invalidates the ability of the grantor, Mr. Sullivan's predecessor, from getting an easement if he so chose?
Well, that's the distinction, I think, that arises between an easement appurtenant and an easement in gross. Here they are asserting that they have an easement running with the land. The question then becomes, with whose land does it run? And it is then tied, at least temporally, to the lease existence. The lease no longer exists as to tract E, even at the time of the grant of what I'll call the Selby easement. And so therefore, I submit that it should have been viewed as a nullity on its face.
But if there was still a lease as to tract E, why would they need an easement? They'd have a lease interest in E.
But they had previously terminated the leasehold interest when one works through this legal description as to the parcel that becomes tract E.
Right.
And so therefore, you're looking at what is it that this subsequent easement affixes to, for lack of a better term? And then what is the intent or purpose saying it runs contemporaneously or contemporaneously with the easement, with the leasehold interest, that leasehold interest as to that tract E no longer existed?
But as a matter of interpreting the document, it doesn't terminate based on the leasehold interest in tract E. It terminates if the lease terminates, and the lease is a broader package of rights and liabilities than just what impacts tract E. So I mean, why should the plain language of that document, you know, not as a matter of real estate law, but as a matter of contract interpretation, why should it be interpreted as essentially a terminating event is abandoning leasehold interest in tract E as opposed to terminating the entire lease, which I assume covers a vastly greater amount of area than tract E?
It certainly does cover something broader than tract E, and at the time of these subsequent grants and conveyances, there were different grantees and grantors in the chain of title. I submit that the document, and that is the easement document itself, I don't think is altogether that clear, and I think it takes extrinsic proof or extrinsic evidence to establish what it is that was terminated or what it was affixed to.
Okay, did you argue to the lower court that there's a question of ambiguity in the easement document which calls for the introduction of parole evidence?
Not in those terms. We argued the chain of title and the sequence of events.
Okay, but you didn't make essentially a parole evidence ambiguity argument and make an offer of proof of parole evidence parole.
No, it's not there.
Thank you.
I think that the distinction, if we look at this purported easement grant and we look at it in connection with the body of case law, there are no remaining interests that the fee holder actually has in this. This is tantamount to a fee grant, if we are to look at that in accordance with its terms. That, I think, is what I would suggest that this court I apologize, I take a medicine that dries my mouth out, so I apologize if I might just get a sip of water.
Sure.
Thank you for your indulgence. But I don't think that this sequence is factually or legally so dissimilar from that found in the Arvada case that we were talking about.
Well, let me ask you a question about that Arvada case. In that case, there was a person who had water interests but not surface land interests.
That is correct. They had a deeded right to subsurface water. They required access to get to that wellhead and that well location.
Right. So in that case, The holding depended on the fact that there was no interest in the surface land in order to get an easement over land to access that surface land.
That there was no pertinent interest to which it could run with.
Right. So isn't this case distinguishable because we aren't talking about subsurface water rights?
Well, of course, any case is distinguishable when you reach to that level. But the black letter statements in that case, I don't believe, are factually distinguishable. And that's why I have gone through and perhaps confused things about the nature of the lease termination with regard to what is known as Tract E.
Right, but what about the land surrounding Tract E where there still is a lease?
It goes back to these separate lines of grantor grantees that remain with regard to that ownership. As to Tract E at the time of this grant, in terms of the Tract E ownership, Denver Country Club no longer had a possessory surface right interest with regard to Tract E because the leasehold had previously been terminated. And that's why I think the logic applies.
Do they have a surface right to the land surrounding Tract E?
They have surface rights to land adjacent to or in the vicinity, but not with regard to Tract E. I believe, frankly, that the chain of title, so to speak, is broken when Tract E, and sort of it's described in a different legal description, the leasehold interest is terminated.
But I mean, is it your position that the beneficiary of the easement here, Denver Country Club, has to have some sort of interest in the burden tract, which is Tract E, or otherwise the easement fails?
Otherwise, it would have been treated as if this were a fee grant, and that's the distinction between the easement nature of the grant and a fee grant. And I believe that they had to, under the unique terms of this easement grant, and its intended purpose, they had to have had a retained interest in Tract E. That is my position.
Okay, and you're basing that on a general legal principle that would apply to all cases, or you're basing that on specific language in this easement?
I think it is a little bit of both. I think that this case and the easement grant on itself, when you look at the language, you look at the description, and you look at the granting language, it is akin to the very same concept that was in the WRWC LLC City of Arvada. In my mind, looking at it, it is legally and factually indistinguishable as a matter of law.
And what language can you point to us in the easement document that has that legal effect that you're arguing?
Because it is tied to a temporal grant, that being a non-ownership interest in a leasehold that had previously been abandoned.
Okay, but doesn't that just get back to my question earlier as to whether we're talking about termination of the entire lease or release of Tract E from the lease?
Well, if we look at it from that perspective, what other intent or purpose could there have been other than to free Tract E under the termination from the burdens of the leasehold interest, which if you align those documents, the leasehold interest is a leasehold for running a golf course or a golf hole or some aspect of it, and the easement grant, they are indistinguishable, the intended purpose. So therefore, the value, so to speak, of the leasehold termination is rendered totally meaningless by virtue of these. And so therefore, you have to interpret these three series of documents together. And that, in my mind, and in my argument, leads to the conclusion that the easement was ineffective. I see I have a minute or two left, if I might reserve that or if there are any other questions.
No.
Your Honors, good morning. My name is Robert Hinckley, and I represent Denver Country Club. Despite the arguments of counsel, this is actually a very simple case. Mr. Solomon purchased Tract E in 1994. The record notice that it was burdened with an easement, a pertinent, that required that it only be used for golf course purposes. Legitimate consideration was provided for the easement in the form of a reciprocal view easement over Denver Country Club property, specifically Parcel 2. The reciprocal easements were properly recorded.
Does the Denver Country Club own parcel two, or is it just leased?
A leasehold in Grumman. A valid easement has existed on the property for 27 years, for many years before Mr. Sullivan purchased this small sliver of property that's adjacent to the country club. The legal arguments that have been provided thus far are not persuasive because there's no support in either the case law or a reading of any of the documents such as the easement.
Counsel, how do you respond to your opponent's argument that Denver Country Club needed to have some sort of retained interest in track D in order for the easement to be valid, if I'm understanding his argument?
Your Honor, to be frank with you, I've read the briefing multiple times and I still can't figure it out. There's nothing in the easement that in any way makes the validity of the easement contingent on a leasehold existing for DCC in track E. And we've got to remember the temporal context as well. This easement is 20 years after the surrender of lease that occurred. So it doesn't make sense logically that this could be the case. And in fact, a plain reading of the easement shows that a plain reading shows that the lease that's being considered is the lease as to parcel two or parcel B, depending on how you read the survey. That leasehold interest still exists. It exists today, it existed at the time in 1966 when the surrender occurred, it existed in 1986 when the easement was obtained. So it exists today, it always has. So there is no legal or factual connection between a leasehold interest in track E and whether or not the easement itself is valid.
I want to be sure I understood what you said. The tract E was released from the leasehold interest many years before the easement agreement was executed.
Yes, Your Honor. And if I can clarify for you, in 1955, the golf course obtained two parcels, A and B, to use as a golf course. There was a 99-year lease that was entered into with the opportunity for additional leases if notice was given. In 1957, a third parcel was obtained, which was identified as parcel C on the survey. In 1966, there was a partial surrender of lease of a pie-shaped piece of land that was released from the lease. Included within that pie piece was tract E. So from 1966 forward, there was no leasehold interest that DCC had in that property. 20 years after the surrender of lease occurred, the prior owner of tract E, Mr. Selby, entered into an easement agreement with DCC whereby there would be mutual easements of pertinent, whereby DCC would provide a view easement over its property and Mr. Selby would provide a golf course easement over his property, meaning that only golf course purposes could be used related to that property. So from a temporal perspective, this is 20 years after the surrender of lease of the easement occurred.
Now, is that an easement in gross or an easement in pertinent, and does that matter?
I believe it does matter, Your Honor, and it is clearly an easement of pertinent because we have two parcels of land. And it's because DCC had a valid leasehold interest in parcel B, it had a possessory interest in parcel B. And because of that fact, it could validly hold an easement against the Serbian state, and they are adjacent, they don't need to be. But in this case, they are adjacent to each other. So because DCC had a valid possessory interest in parcel B, it could validly hold an easement over the Bourbon property, which was tract E, which is the property owned by Mr. Sullivan.
So in the City of Arvada case, there was no valid possessory interest in the land appurtenant to the land burdened by the easement.
Correct. And it was an interesting fact pattern because in that case, the appellant who ironically was represented by Mr. Polk, I believe Mr. Webb, Judge Webb, you were on that case as well. In that case, the appellant had only water rights. And the court held correctly that water rights do not create land rights. And because of that, although they had water rights, they had no ability to use the easement appurtenant because they couldn't show that they had possessory rights. Now, the engrossed part of the case came into being because the other argument by appellant was that there was a written easement to use some materials on the dominant estate, and there was an easement to use the well, and appellant tried to argue that that created an easement an easement appurtenant, and therefore he should be able to use the serving in the state to access his water rights. But the court found that what it actually had created was an easement in gross. And an easement in gross does not provide possessory rights whereby you can use the serving in the state. So the facts in that case are not in any way similar to the facts here. They're easily distinguishable. And the fact is that there is no law that supports the arguments that counsel has provided to you this morning. In fact, it flies in the face of very clear black letter law, which states that the possessory interest, and this is his second argument, must be in the dominant state. There's no reason to have a possessory interest in the serving estate, or else you wouldn't need an easement at all. It's illogical. So as to that second argument, we've established clearly that you did have a possessory interest in parcel B. Therefore, the easement against tract E was valid and reasonable and enforceable. And as to the other argument, this temporal argument is hard to discuss because it doesn't make sense. An easement 20 years later cannot be vitiated by a surrender of lease 20 years prior. Now, there's nothing in the easement itself that states that there's any contingency whereby if a leasehold interest in tract E is removed, therefore the easement is destroyed or terminated. It couldn't have been the case because it was 20 years later. Having said that, there's nothing in the language of the easement itself that speaks to the idea that there's any legal or factual connection between the two. In fact, the only reason why the easement tracks the lease terms of parcel B is because there would be no need for the mutual easements if the lease on parcel B is terminated. Meaning that if the lease on parcel B is terminated and somebody else is using the property for another reason, there's no reason for a view easement or a golf course easement. That's the only reason why they track. There is no other legal connection between the easement in 1986 and any leasehold interest in tract E before 1966.
Council, go ahead. Are you aware of any authority that exists to the effect that because a lease or a lease as to a segment of land is surrendered, that somehow that surrender prohibits later property owners or the same property owner at a later time from granting some other interest in that?
None, Your Honor, and I believe it's telling that counsel was not able to provide you any legal authority to support that position because, frankly, in my research, it does not exist. Another aspect of an easement of pertinent that's important to consider is that it runs with the land, meaning that when the land is purchased by a subsequent purchaser, that easement runs with it. So the fact that Mr. Sullivan didn't enter into the easement agreement, didn't agree to it, does not in any way allow him to get out of the force of the easement itself.
And all these documents were properly recorded, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. And Judge Stern, in his order, stated that specifically, that all proper documents, including the 55 lease, the 57 lease, the easement, were all properly recorded. And Mr. Sullivan certainly had notice of their existence prior to the purchase.
I was just going to ask about the language then in the easement, that it should run for the term of the 1955 lease. So the meaning of that is not a legal connection, but what does it mean?
Well, to my understanding and to my belief, there is a 99-year lease that was entered into for these parcels. These parcels are used for a golf course. There's an opportunity for additional extensions beyond that. Now, the easement, when it was entered into in 1986, both the owner of Track E and DCC agreed that the easement, the time, the duration of it, would run consistent with the leases for parcels A, B, and C. It specifically says parcel B because that's the parcel that's adjacent to Track E. Now, there would be no reason to have a golf course easement if there's no golf course. So it would make sense that when the golf course lease is terminated, that the easement would terminate at the same time because there would be no purpose for the easement after that occurred.
So what you're saying is that language connecting it is just language connecting it to a time period.
Correct.
Not actual.
That's exactly my point, Your Honor, and I believe that a reading of the easement will confirm that position. It states that the easement will track the lease in parcel B. The lease in parcel B still exists today and will continue until 2054 and likely will continue for another 99-year term. So that exists. So for for purposes of having a lease to track, it still exists. And the easement that's identified, or the lease that's identified in the easement, is still proper today. So the fact that there's not a leasehold interest in Track E has no legal or other effect on the validity of the easement. With that said, Your Honors, based on all that has been provided to you in briefing, Denver Country Club would ask that you affirm Judge Stern's ruling, as we believe that summary judgment was appropriate in this case. Thank you.
I don't want to be a broken record, and I'll try to be as concise as I can.
You have a minute.
Okay. I'm getting old and the lights baffle me. It's my understanding that this court in the WRWC case specifically determined what an appurtenant easement was, and that there had to be a possessory interest as to the real estate to which it was appended, for lack of a better term. The effect of the combination of these series of documents.
Well, WRC was another division of this court, correct?
It was another division.
Oh, so we don't have to follow it anyway?
No, you don't. But
why does that rule then make sense? I mean, just in terms of traditional principles of property law.
Well, the only thing I can tell you is the Supreme Court denied cert in that. It is consistent with the lazy dog decision. And I think that that law is appropriate. And I think it is an expansion that we're seeking, perhaps, or a reasonable reading of that case.
Okay.
Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. The written opinion will be issued in due course.